All right, we just finished chapter 23, which began what significant portion of the Gospel of Matthew? The fifth major discourse in the Gospel of Matthew began in chapter 23. And what did chapter 23 consist of? Predominantly the seven woes, and it was geared towards whom? The Pharisees in particular, the teachers of the law, but he has the Jewish elite in mind as a whole, correct? Yes. Goes through the seven woes. It climaxes in the seventh woe, which had to deal with what? What's that? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. What? Yeah, the killing of the prophets. Yes. The killing, you were right. Don't mumble, man. Yell it out. The killing of the prophets. The killing of God's servants. And that's the way consistently that the Jewish elite will respond to whenever God sent someone their way. Instead of listening to them, heeding to them, changing what they believed, changing what they were doing, what they did instead was ignored what they were saying and killed them. And Jesus says, you're going to do the same thing to me. And then at the end of chapter 23, he starts to lament. He cries out in verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. He says, my word, the judgments that's going to be coming, I hate it. Because what I long more than anything is to pull you under my wing, to protect you, to love you, to guide you, but you don't want that. What do you want? Your own kingdom. You don't want my kingdom. You don't want what I'm offering. And then he looks at them and he says, well, I'm sure they were listening still. Verse 38, look, your house is left to you desolate. And what did we suggest that phrase described? The destruction of the temple. Then in verse 38, he makes a prediction of the destruction of the temple. Look, your house is left to you desolate. Then he goes on and he basically quotes Psalm 118 saying, this victory psalm will not look the way that you think it'll look. Because in Psalm 118, when he's talking about the battle cry, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, that will make sense to you whenever the destruction of the temple actually occurs. And yet he also knows that even when that happens, they won't accept it. So, we're entering now into Matthew 24, and what we're going to see is that we initially changed locations, but we are not changing topics. What ends chapter 23 is what will dominate the first half of chapter 24. Now listen to me very carefully, more than any other day, more than any other chapter, you have to hang with me. Chapter 24, I'm just going to be flat out honest with you, it is complicated. It is very convoluted. There is loads of baggage that we're going to have to fight through. But I promise, everybody in here can handle it. It really is understandable. But you can't check out, really, at any moment. At any moment, you can't check out. These are coming around. These will come in handy. It's some sort of appendices to what we're talking about here that'll help you understand some of the details we're looking at. So is everybody following me? More than at any time this semester, you have to check with me. Otherwise, comes the end of Matthew 24, you won't have a clue what it was talking about. Because it is complicated. Cool? Fair warning. Disclaimer over. Let's go. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Now notice what's happening. The end of chapter 23, Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple. So Jesus and his disciples then are leaving the temple, and what do his disciples do? Man, Jesus, do you see how cool that building is? I mean, look how magnificent it is. It is just gorgeous. So, I mean, what could honestly penetrate that? And Jesus says this in verse 2. Do you see all these things pointing to the temple? I tell you the truth. Not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. What's he just done? He's predicted the destruction of the temple for the second time. This is not the first time that he predicts the destruction. It's the second time. The first one's at the end of chapter 23. Then he begins the conversation after they're gawking over the scene. He says, let me remind you, not one stone is going to stand. As a matter of fact, you're going to see in a minute, verse 3, as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, which was a very traditional thing for Jews to do when they were leaving Jerusalem. When you would leave Jerusalem, a lot of times what you do is you would come to the Mount of Olives, you would sit and you'd look back and reflect on the city. And what they would have been seeing is something like this without the big dome in the middle. They'd have been looking down and they would have been seeing these magnificent walls that stretched up. But they're looking from a mountain to a mountain. over a valley. What's interesting here is right out here, my little brother was telling me a lot of this is decorated with graves now. But this is the wall of the temple, and it would stretch around most of what you can see up there. The Temple of the Rock there, the Dome of the Rock, where the key Muslim mosque is at now, that place right there would have been where the temple was standing. A magnificent structure. But something that this would have been their scene as they're talking throughout all of Matthew 24. You have to keep that in mind. The whole time he's talking about the destruction of the temple, they're staring at it. You see the issue? So they're looking at it saying, how magnificent is this place? And Jesus says, I promise you, not a single one of these stones will be standing. Not a single one of them. Which prompts the question. Notice how I've broken up Matthew 24. Actually, I probably should give you my thesis. So I'm going to do this deductively. We're not going to do this inductively. I'm going to tell you what I think about the Matthew 24 and 25, and then we're going to walk through of why that is possible. Okay, so here is my thesis. In answering the question of the disciples, which we're going to be getting here in verse 3, Christ separates the destruction of the temple and the second coming as two separate events. Okay? That are both involved in the creation of a new heaven and a new earth. So he says, they ask a question. We're going to talk about in a minute what that question was. He is going to, in answering that question, separate the events. Destruction of the temple, second coming. Both of them, though, have in common that it is the creation of a new heavens and a new earth in both of the events. We're going to talk about how that makes sense by and by. The discourse reveals the key contrast, however, between the two events, which are, number one, separated by a significant length of time. That becomes very clear in Matthew chapter 24 and 25, the end of chapter 24 and 25. He consistently is talking about the significant length of time between them. And in that the destruction of the temple will be clearly evident by signs preceding it, while the second coming will occur unexpectedly without any signs or warning. Do you see the key difference? So this is, let me summarize so far. This is my thesis. They ask a question. Jesus says, here's my answer. The two events are separate. Destruction of the temple, second coming. How are they different? Number one, they're separated by a significant length of time. Number two, the destruction of the temple, there will be sign after sign after sign after sign that it's coming. But the second coming, there are no signs. It just is going to happen. That's how they're different. How are they similar? They both are the creation of a new heavens and a new earth. Brand new creation in both instances. You see what's happening? That's my argument. Now let's see what happens. Here's the question. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen? What is this they're talking about? Destruction of the temple. Because that's the context of their question, right? Leading into the question, he predicts the destruction of the temple twice. When will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? The way in which the NIV has constructed this makes it sound like they're asking two different questions. And that is not true. And here's the reason why. The chi, everybody know what the word chi is in Greek? What is it? And, simply and. However, the word and, even in our language, functions in different ways in different contexts, doesn't it? The way in which the function of the word chi here is called epexegetical. Greek scholars, what is epexegetical a chi? An exegetical chi, what is it doing? Anybody? It's explanatory. It's building upon the same concept. In other words, this is how I would retranslate the way in which the word is being used. Say to us when these things will be. That is. See the difference? That is. What will be the sign of your coming and full completion of the age? Now we have another chi, don't we? We have two chis here. Right? What is the second one? Anybody know what rule the second one follows? If you're looking in the Greek, it's very clear. Who's taking Greek in here? You in Greek too, anybody at least? Do we know what the Granville Sharp rule is? Okay, what is it? What is the Granville Sharp rule? Again, hang with me. What?
There's a two different articles and it's two separate things, but there's only one definite article and it's the same thing.
Exactly. That if you have two definite article, if you have a word, okay, if you have a word in the middle and it's conjoined by chi, and this first phrase and the second phrase both have the, a definite article at the beginning of them. They are two separate things if they both have the. The blank and the blank, two separate things. However, if you only have a definite article at the first one, what does that mean? What is it now? Granville Sharp Rule says it's what? Describing what? They're both of the same thing. The blank and blank would mean that you're basically, this thing is describing this thing as well. And that is exactly the way the construction is. It follows the Granville Sharp Rule to a T, the way in which this is constructed at the end. And that is what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age. In other words, the sign of your coming and the end of the age to them is the exact same thing. You see what they're doing? They're taking, when will these things happen? When, what is these things referring to? The destruction of the temple. That is, notice how this is developing, that is the sign of your coming and the end of the age. They're saying the second coming, the destruction of the temple, same thing. When's this going to happen? You see what they're asking? It is not two separate questions. It is one question that is conflating two separate events into one. If you don't understand what I'm saying right now, you need to ask me a question because this is the basis from which everything else is developed. Anybody not understand what I'm saying here? It's okay if you don't. Don't be shy because there's probably other people that agree with you if you don't.
Can you just yes. Repeat it one more time?
Absolutely. This is what's happening. Jesus comes and he says, destruction of the temple. In their mind, because they're thinking through a Jewish lens, they're thinking, if the temple's destroyed, that must mean the end of everything. The end of everything. Because in their mind, what could destroy this and not destroy the whole world? So what is their question? Okay, so when's everything going to end? I mean, when is the destruction of the temple going to end? When's your coming going to happen? When's everything over? That's what they're asking. They take the events and they conflate them into one. The way in which their question is structured in the Greek leaves me no other option. The first chi is epexegetical, which would be, let me retranslate it then. The disciples ask, say to us when these things will happen. These things are referring to the destruction of the temple. That is, when will these things happen? That is, what the sign of your coming and full completion of the age? When's all that? When is that going to happen? They're not seeing multiple events. They're seeing one event. Make sense? The rest of what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 24 up to verse 35, actually through chapter 25, he is going to be telling them what you're saying is one event is actually two. And here's why. So do you see how the conversation begins? He predicts the temple. They think that means the end of everything. So they ask him, when's everything going to be over? You know, the destruction of the temple. When's all that going to happen? And he says, hold on, your question is flawed. You're asking a question through the lens of a Jew, because if the destruction of the temple happens, that must mean the end of everything. And yet he looks at me and says, but that's not true. As a matter of fact, there will be a destruction of the temple, but a significant period of time will occur before everything ends. And here's how they're different. Okay? Everybody tracking now? Good. All right. Now we get into the good stuff. Verse 4. Note this structure is very important to understand how we're moving. We start off with the comment and the question. Jesus makes a comment about the temple. They say, when's everything going to end? Jesus then begins in verse 4 up through 22. He's going to be describing the events surrounding and including the abomination of desolation. Which that will be very... The question in and of itself is, what is this? We assume we know what the abomination of desolation is, but I'm going to argue that what we assume is wrong. What he's going to do then is I'm going to break these up into two separate categories. 4 through 14 is the events leading up to the abomination of desolation. Once we get to verse 15 through 22, it's going to be describing the abomination of desolation and the events shortly thereafter. See how I'm breaking this up? So we're moving to the abomination of desolation until we hit verse 22. Once we go to verse 23 through 31, events surrounding including the destruction of the temple. What do you notice by my structure? What do you notice? Something significant about that. I'm separating this and this. Initially, my structure, you see, my definition of abomination of desolation is not the destruction of the temple, which a lot of people say it is, but it's not. And we'll talk about why that is. And then ultimately, he comes after the events surrounding, including the destruction of the temple. He will summarize it all with the parable of a fig tree, which should remind us of something else that's happened recently. What is that? Chapter 21, what happens? Curse of fig tree. And what did we describe as the context of that curse of the fig tree? Judgment on Israel. Wouldn't that make sense in the whole concept of destruction of the temple? Okay. Oh, I love this stuff. Okay, verse 4. Oh, wow. Okay. Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you." Now, here is my initial assumption. He is not talking about the second coming. Why would I say that after I stopped, after just 1 second personal pronoun? Who is the you defined in that passage? The disciples! Right? As a matter of fact, Gleason Archer, who is not an amillennial, he's not a future, or he is a futurist guy. He does say, though, if we try to apply the word you to anyone other than the disciples in this passage, well, at that point, all hermeneutical rules can be thrown out the window. Why? Because if you doesn't mean you, then I can make any other word mean whatever I want. He says, "What I want you to make sure that you, disciples, are not deceived." That's why I'm going to tell you this stuff. Because it's very easy to get this confused. I want to make sure that you are not deceived. Also, I would suggest that he is talking about the destruction of the temple based on context. He predicts the temple twice. They ask the question about the temple. Why all of a sudden now would he ignore the question and move to something different like the second coming? So he's saying you and the fact we're in context. I think he's saying let's talk about the temple. And that becomes clear as we keep going. "For many will come in my name." Here, let me say this though. There is a key question I want us to ask. I want us to ask throughout the next 30 verses. Does what he describes match the events that surround AD 70? AD 70 is the date in which the temple was destroyed. AD 66 through 73 is usually the time period described within that destruction. And the question I want to know is the events leading up to that, surrounding that, do they fit what Jesus describes? That's an important question, right? Because if they don't, then he may not be talking about the destruction of the temple. If they do, maybe we should allow the context to dictate that. You following why I'm asking that? Do these events match up with what happens around AD 70? "For many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." Okay. Did that occur? Look at your first appendix on the paper I gave you. Because what I have there comes out of Richard Horsley's books, Bandits, Prophets, and Messiahs. And notice the section on Messiahs. We have several. Now, what's interesting is that Horsley's, I would argue that his table, according to church history, is probably a little more conservative than what church historians were saying at the time. Let me read you a quote from Jerome in his commentary on Matthew. Jerome says this: "At the time of the Jewish captivity by Rome, so around AD 70, many Jewish leaders claimed to be the Christ." Do you hear that? Jerome says that around the time when Jerusalem was captured by Rome, many Jewish leaders were claiming to be the Christ. There were so many, in fact, Jerome says, that there were three distinct camps of them when the Romans besieged Jerusalem. So here's my question. At the time surrounding the destruction of the temple, was there many people that are claiming to be Christ and deceiving many? Yeah. Church history says no question. Why? Because in times of turmoil, Jews will look for a messianic figure. Because a messianic figure is supposed to bring them liberation. Okay? All right, let's keep reading. "You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed." Again, same sort of evidence. We have Caligula in 39, where the temple was almost destroyed in 39. To kind of say it shortly, there was a conflict between the emperor and the Jews because the Jews were refusing to allow an imperial cult statue honoring Caligula into one of their synagogues. They said, "We don't want it." He says, "If you don't have it in there, I'm going to destroy you." And they say, "Sorry, we're not going to do it." They end up destroying one of his images, which sets him off. He says, "You know what I'm going to do instead? I'm going to take a statue of myself, half me, half Zeus. I'm going to put it up in your temple. And that'll show you who's boss." And everybody in Rome was on edge. Because they knew, Josephus even says, had it been accomplished that Caligula got the statue to the temple, he says the destruction of the temple would have happened in 39, not in 70. What happened? Caligula was assassinated mysteriously. And immediately, the general, who had been stalling for about a year and a half now, immediately called it off. Claudius comes to power, he revokes the edict, and we have a restraining period. If you're thinking 2 Thessalonians 2, good. A restraining period before the temple is destroyed. So were there wars and rumors of wars? Yeah, there were. Not to mention the fact there was unrest and invasions that plagued the empire in the time of Claudius, in the time of Nero. As a matter of fact, leading up in the years from 67 to 70, we had at least 4 different emperors. Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian. Because the entire empire was thrown into civil war. And there was a big clawing for power whenever Nero dies. And people are fighting. We have a year of 3 emperors. A lot of unrest. A lot of wars. Rumors of wars. Of collapsing of the empire. But whenever Vespasian gains power after destroying the temple with his son Titus, that's whenever the Flavian dynasty begins. With Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian. Roman history. I like it. Sorry. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Keep your finger on that word, end is still to come. We'll come back to that. Verse 7, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. Okay, first let me talk about the earthquakes, then let me talk about the famines. Were there earthquakes? Absolutely. As a matter of fact, one historian writes, classical and modern authors record at least 17 major earthquakes in the early Christian period, at least. At least. We have one significant one in AD 60, which destroyed the city of Laodicea, which pops up in Revelation, and destroys Colossae, which Colossians was written to, and Hierapolis. Decimated all 3 of them at once. Were there earthquakes? No question, leading up to AD 66 and 70, there were earthquakes. But let me talk about the famine. Turn with me to Appendix C that I gave you there, because I want to read you a little excerpt about a famine that Josephus records regarding the events surrounding the destruction of the temple. During the time leading up to the destruction of the temple, there was a massive famine. And this is what, I'm going to read a lot of this, so I might be skipping around a bit. Follow me. Josephus, Appendix C, it says atrocities of AD 66 through 73, Josephus wars 6.3.3-4. Everybody there? Okay. Now, if you have a squeamish stomach, I'm sorry, because this gets a little bit graphic. He says, now of those perished by famine in the city, the number was prodigious, and of the miseries they underwent were unspeakable. For if so much as the shadow of any kind of food did anywhere appear, a war was commenced presently. And the dearest friends fell a-fighting one with another about it, snatching from each other the most miserable supports of life. Nor would men believe that those who were dying had no food. But the robbers would search them. People that were dying. The robbers come up and they're searching them when they were expiring, lest anyone should have concealed food in their bosoms and counterfeited dying. People faking death just to get away from the robbers so they can preserve food. Skip down to 197. Moreover, their hunger was so intolerable that it obliged them to chew everything, while they gathered such things as the most sordid animals would not touch, and endured to eat them. Nor did they at length abstain from girdles and shoes. Literally, they're eating them. And the very leather which belonged to their shields, they pulled off and gnawed. If you've ever been to Haiti and talked about people in extreme poverty, you'll see that they do make dirt pies down there. Because that's all there is to eat. Go down to 201. Now this gets a little bit graphic. This is the famine surrounding the time of the destruction of the temple. There was a certain woman that dwelt beyond Jordan. Her name was Mary. Her father was Eleazar and of the village Bethesda, which signifies the house of hyssop. She was eminent for her family and her wealth and had fled away to Jerusalem with the rest of the multitude and was with them besieged therein at this time. So she goes to Jerusalem, but now she's being besieged just like the rest of the city by the Romans. The other effects of this woman had been already seized upon. In other words, everything else she owned, people had already taken it. Such, I mean, as she had brought with her out of Perea and removed to the city. which she had treasured up besides as also what food she had contrived to save, had also been carried off by the rapacious guards, who came every day running into her house for that purpose. This put the poor woman into a very great passion. And by the frequent reproaches and imprecations she cast at these rapacious villains, she had provoked them to anger against her. So she's fighting back. But none of them, either out of the indignation she had raised against herself or out of the commiseration of her case, would take her life away. Skip down just a line. And it was now become impossible for her anyway to find any more food. While the famine pierced through her very bowels and marrow, and also her passion was fired to a degree beyond the famine itself, nor did she consult with anything but with her passion and necessity she was in. She then attempted a most unnatural thing. Snatching up her son, who was a child sucking at her breast, she said, "O thou miserable infant, for whom shall I preserve thee in this war, this famine, and this sedition? As to the war with the Romans, if they preserve our lives, we must be slaves. This famine also will destroy us even before that slavery comes upon us. Yet are these seditious rogues more terrible than both the other? Come on, be thou my food. And be thou a fury to these seditious varlets and a byword to the world, which is all that is now wanting to complete the calamities of us Jews." As soon as she had said this, she slew her son, and then roasted him and ate the one half of him, and kept the other half by her concealed. Upon this, the seditious came in presently, and smelling the horrid scent of this food, they threatened her that they would cut her throat immediately if she did not show them what food had gotten ready. She replied that she had saved a very fine portion of it for them, and withal uncovered what was left of her son. Hereupon they were seized with a horror and amazement of mind and stood astonished at the sight, when she said to them, "This is mine own son, and what hath been done was mine own doing. Come, eat of this food, for I have eaten of it myself. Do not pretend to be either more tender than a woman or more compassionate than a mother, but if you be so scrupulous and do abominate this my sacrifice, as I have eaten the one half, let the rest be reserved for me also." In other words, if you're not going to eat it, let me eat the rest of my son. After which those men went out trembling, being never so much affrighted at anything as they were at this. And with some difficulty they left the rest of the meat to the mother. This is the famine that is surrounding the destruction of the temple. Very clearly I can say, yes, the famines and earthquakes described by Jesus as leading up to the destruction of the temple very much were real. A matter of fact, we're going to read in a moment that if you want to have an understanding of the atrocities, the church fathers say, just read Josephus. It's very clear what happened. Verse 8. All these are the beginning of birth pains. Why would he describe birth pains? Because of a couple things. Number one, a new creation is about to come on the scene. Just like a woman that is in birthing moments, the moments leading up to it, I've seen it 3 times because my wife had a natural birth every time. You know that what's about to happen is a new creation. And number two, this is the most important. At that point, it's inevitable. Birth pains aren't just a sign of something that's coming. That people say that and I'm going, no, you're missing the point. Birth pains are pointing to two things: a new creation and the inevitability of the coming of that new creation. It's going to come. When a woman starts to have birth pains, she can't just say, I don't really want to have the baby now. I think I'll just wait. Sorry. Whenever the birthing pains really come, it's a coming whether you like it or not. The baby's coming out. The baby's coming. It's inevitable. And that's what he's saying about the new creation, about the destruction of the temple. It's coming. It's going to happen. It's inevitable. Okay, now we move into verse 9. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted. Who is the you defined there? Has to be. This is not a promise for all Christians, especially those right before the end of everything. He's talking to the disciples. And if you doesn't mean you, then nothing means anything. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. Mark and Luke add a couple of different details to this. They also include Mark 13:9, Luke 21:12, which are very important parallel passages to Matthew 24. They add, they are being flogged. You will be flogged in synagogues. You will be put into prison. You will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to the gospel. What does that sound like? Book of Acts. Which happens before the destruction of the temple. Yeah? At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. Second time Jesus has used the word end. Yes? When was the other time? Verse 6. 6 and 13. We're going to get it a third time here in chapter, or in verse 14. This is a passage that has been talked about quite frequently on our campus by a fellow professor. And we're going to deal with that issue before we end today. Verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Okay. Here's the issue. So far, what context are we in? Destruction of the temple. He predicts it at the end of 23, predicts it again in 24. They ask the question. He says, let's start describing the events leading up to the abomination of desolation. And we can find these leading up to the temple. It's weird because all of a sudden, if we misdefine the word end, it seems like verse 14 jumps us to the end of everything. As soon as the last missionary is preached, the gospel to the last person to hear, bam, Jesus is back. And where does that come from? Matthew chapter 24, verse 14. The only text that would say something like that. But here's my question. Is that really what Jesus is saying there? Context would say, well, maybe he's saying something a little different. So what is he saying? First of all, let's look at the word end. Actually, no. Let's look at the word whole world. Because there's a theological bias in the translation of that word, oikumene, as whole world. Because actually, at one point in early Greek, oikumene was used to just describe the world, kind of like cosmos. But by the time of the first century, it had developed in its meaning to where oikumene was being used not just to describe the inhabited world, but specifically being used to describe the Roman Empire. Where's my evidence? All I have to do is look in the Gospels themselves. Luke chapter 2, verse 1. Caesar Augustus orders a census for the oikumene. What's he order the census for? Rome. Acts chapter 11 verse 28. Agabus predicts there will be a severe famine over the oikumene. And it is translated by the NIV in that context, over the Roman Empire. The word oikumene is used quite often in the Gospels and in the Roman literature to refer to the Roman Empire. Because for them, that's all that needed to exist. That was the world. That's the word he uses here. He does not use cosmos. He doesn't use the generic word for all of the world. He uses the word oikumene because what he's saying is, whenever the gospel is reached to the edges of the inhabited world, Rome, the end will come. Now let's define the word end. We've been talking about the word end several times throughout Matthew, and every time we've talked about it, I said, this will become very important once we get to Matthew 24. And this is what I'm talking about. There are two words for end that are used in the gospel of Matthew. Do you remember what they are? Telos and soon-teleia. In the question by the disciples in verse 3, they ask, and when will the end come? What word do you think they use? Soon-teleia. Why? Because soon-teleia is a word in Matthew that is always used to describe the end of absolutely everything. Matthew chapter 13, when he's talking about the harvest at the end of the age. Three times he uses the word soon-teleia to refer to the end of everything. The end of absolutely everything. Matthew chapter 28, verse 20. Jesus says, and I will be with you to the very soon-teleia of the age. The end of everything. And that's the word that the disciples use in 24:3. When will the end of everything come? The soon-teleia. And Jesus here, in verse 14 says, whenever the gospel is preached to the oikumene, then the telos will come. Totally different word. Why does Jesus shift the words? Because he says an end will come, but it is not the end of everything. Because telos is used throughout the gospel of Matthew to refer to the end of a process, but not the end of everything. My primary evidence for that is Matthew chapter 26, verse 58. But Peter followed him at a distance, followed Jesus at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the telos. the outcome, how the process is going to end. Is he waiting there to see the end of all things? No. He's waiting there to see the end of a process. Jesus shifts the word because he's correcting the disciples. He says, whenever the gospel is preached to the Roman Empire, then the end, the telos, will come. The destruction of the temple then can happen. And what do we find in the gospel or in Pauline letters? Paul thinks that the end is ready. He thinks it's ready. As a matter of fact, Romans 1 verse 8 says, first I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you because your faith is being reported all over the world. Colossians chapter 1 verse 6, all over the world this gospel is bearing fruit and growing. Colossians 1:23, this is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. What does Paul think about the preaching of the gospel? It's covered the oikumene. You know what's significant? Is that Paul, whenever he talks about how far the gospel is spread, he doesn't use oikumene. Guess what he uses? Cosmos. Because he's saying, oh, it's spread beyond even the Roman Empire. It's covered the whole world. Paul thinks that it's the end, that the end can happen now. The end, talking about the telos of the destruction of the temple. As a matter of fact, my argument is that's what he's saying in 2 Thessalonians 2 with the man of lawlessness. You know the second coming couldn't happen because you know the temple hasn't been destroyed yet. Although we have preached to everyone. Matter of fact, Chrysostom, who's writing in the 4th century, he says, writing on the Gospel of Matthew, he writes this, he says, then he added, this Gospel of the Kingdom will be preached throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. The sign of this final time will be the downfall of Jerusalem. Chrysostom says it's fulfilled in AD 70. So, although it is a good missionary sermon to say, all we need to do is just preach the gospel to the last person and then Jesus will come back, as if we control his timeline, that is not what is happening here in Matthew 24:14. It's very clear what he's saying, because everything leading up to it's about the temple. And the very words that he used is focusing it in on not the end of everything, but the end of the temple. The destruction of the temple. We have 3 minutes. I'm going to use them. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. What is the abomination of desolation? First of all, where are we? Jerusalem. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. As a matter of fact, in Luke chapter 21, verse 20, do you want to know how he describes the desolation? 21 verse 20 says, when Jerusalem is being surrounded by the armies. Hello. That's the reason why a lot of people that want this in the future refuse to parallel Luke 21 with Matthew 24. Because he's very clear about what the abomination of desolation is. It's whenever the armies are surrounding the city and they're ready to destroy it. Let me read you this and this will end. This is what I think is happening. No, I'm not going to read that. I'm going to wait because till tomorrow. I do want to get through this one part. We're going to come back to the abomination of desolation. Let no one on the roof of his house go down and take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. Okay, what is he saying? He's saying this. Whenever you see the abomination of desolation, you flee. But you don't just flee. You flee as quick as you possibly stinking can. And you pray that all the obstacles that could possibly stand in your way, like a pregnant woman, man, it is not easy for her to flee quickly. Or like the winter, which would happen in late November and early December, whenever the rain has come down and flooded the wadis. Not easy to flee then. Or the Sabbath. Because if you're a Christian running away on the Sabbath, what are you? You stick out like a sore thumb to the Jews. Yeah? Persecution would fall. As a matter of fact, one writer puts it this way. He says, a Christian congregation fleeing on the Sabbath would have been as recognizable in Palestine as a spotted dog. You're going to stick out like a sore thumb if you're running on Sabbath. And guess what? Jews aren't going to be too happy about that. He's saying, you better hope you can flee and you can flee quick. Pray that it doesn't occur on the Sabbath. Because if it does, it's going to be big problems. And tomorrow I'm going to argue that the abomination of desolation actually does occur on the Sabbath. And yet, because they get the point, they're able to flee in the coming weeks because the abomination of desolation gave them enough time to get out of Dodge because they recognize the signs. But we'll get to that tomorrow. Hopefully, we're going to be behind. Love you guys.